Hello and welcome to AMSSM Sports Medcast. As we approach the 2024 AMSSM annual meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, there are so many things to be excited for. There are the fantastic sessions led by leaders in the field, ultrasound didactics, the collaborative research network, catching up with past colleagues, and networking future ones. We highlight the top sports medicine articles feature on this podcast, but today we'll spotlight how most of these articles begin, with podium and case presentations. At last year's annual meeting, I was able to interview two presenters, Josh Romero and Jacob Holtz. Unfortunately, we had some audio issues and thought they would be lost to us. We were able to salvage them and bring them to you today on the precipice of this year's meeting. First, we'll hear from Josh Romero, a current fellow at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, who was featured for his oral research presentation entitled Long-Term Outcomes of Platelet Plasma Injections with Needle Fasciotomy for Chronic Plantar Fasciopathy. We'll then listen to Jacob Holtz's cases, Compressed for Time, which was selected as the best case presentation in Phoenix last year. At the time, Jacob was a part of the Notre Dame Sports Medicine Fellowship Program. Now, he is a sports medicine physician with Hendricks Regional Health in Danville, Indiana.
Today, we are highlighting some of the original research presented, 2023 AMSSM Annual Meeting held in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy Schroeder, and I am joined today by Joshua Romero. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Well, I want to review your oral research presentation you delivered at our AMSSM Annual Meeting. Your project entitled Long-Term Outcomes of Platelet-Rich Plasma Injection with Needle Fasciotomy for Chronic Plantar Fasciopathy. Now, Josh, plantar fasciopathy is a very common MSK condition. It is estimated to account for over 1 million physician visits annually in the United States alone. And even among athletes, the condition affects over an estimated 15% of the running population. It can be very challenging for us to treat. Now, can you review some of the standard management approaches?
Yeah, as you mentioned, this can certainly be a challenging condition to treat. Some of the standard approaches to treatment include, I won't have an exhaustive list, but include physical therapy, plus or minus orthotics, certainly activity modification as well. Corticosteroids, there's been some mixed evidence on this, but certainly corticosteroids have been shown to be effective in the short term. Extracorporeal shockwave therapy has been shown to be effective as well. And then when we start getting into the realm of orthobiologics, namely of which PRP, there's been some mixed evidence for this as well. That's kind of the spectrum of treatment options that we think of for plantar fasciopathy.
All right, thanks, Josh. Now, moving on specifically with your study on evaluating the effectiveness of PRP for plantar fasciopathy, what was the basis of your study specifically?
Yeah, so where this actually came up was a patient had asked in clinic about PRP for plantar fasciopathy and asked, gosh, how long do we think that this could last for? And so this prompted us to do a deep dive in the literature to understand how PRP has been used and how long outcomes have been. And a lot of studies are showing outcomes 3, 6, and up to 12 months. And there was one study that did talk about outcomes up to 36 months. This was a study that looked at multiple interventions, but they looked up to 36 months. But once we get beyond 36 months, there's really not anything reported to date in the literature for PRP for plantar fasciopathy. And so we saw that this being a gap in the literature. And so we really wanted to look at a longer term efficacy data for the treatment of plantar fasciopathy with PRP.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about your methods and setup of your study.
So we really set out to answer the question, what is the long-term patient satisfaction, change in pain, and function in patients treated with PRP injection with needle fasciotomy for chronic plantar fasciopathy? So what we did is we conducted a single-center retrospective review of patients treated from June 6, 2008 through November 16, 2020, who had consented to our orthobiologics outcome registry. So we obtained patient-reported outcomes via electronic medical record, electronic patient surveys, and phone interviews. And really, our primary outcome was looking at patient-reported satisfaction with the procedure using a Likert scale. We also looked at multiple secondary outcomes as well. I'll just highlight a few of those here. We wanted to look at mean change in baseline and current VAS pain scores, VAS pain with the first 5 steps, and VAS pain with weight bearing, as well as global assessment of functioning. And then the last thing would just be the time from procedure to the last follow-up. So those are some of the things that we wanted to look at. So our inclusion criteria. So we looked at any patient with having a clinical diagnosis of plantar fasciopathy / fasciosis or fasciitis, just to be inclusive. And they had to be treated at our academic medical center, and they had to be treated in the allotted time frame that I mentioned earlier. So my exclusion criteria was any treatment after November 6, 2020, having any previous plantar fascia surgery, any advanced procedure such as a percutaneous fasciotomy and debridement, any previous orthobiologic procedure, and or the presence of a symptomatic fibroma.
Awesome. It sounds like a very well-designed study overall, very, very intense. I like the inclusion criteria that's there. Specifically, what highlights to me is that your study time frame is about 12 years, which is a lot of time, and there's been a lot of evolution with platelet-rich plasma over that time. Can you tell us a little bit about the consistency with the type and approach with PRP?
Yeah, certainly that's one of the things that we've seen is, you know, we've seen the orthobiologics field in general has grown substantially, and there's been a lot of literature highlighting different aspects of the procedure in terms of preparation of PRP, pre and post procedural considerations. And so we wanted to take that into account as much as we could when we conducted this study. So as such, we wanted to look at the PRP cell composition of the patients that were included in our cohort. We had a total of 19 patients that really responded to the surveys and fit our inclusion criteria. And 4 out of those 19 patients, we were able to analyze their PRP cell composition. Now, for the other procedures, we were not able to do so because we didn't have that in our orthobiologics outcome registry. So all that to say, that is one of the limitations of our study, is that how this data was captured, there's been an evolution of this. And so we don't have that data available for the earlier procedures. And so that's something that we have standardized now at our center, but that wasn't necessarily in place earlier on.
Yes, definitely back when we started 10, 12 years ago, and it was really evolving with orthobiologics and regenerative medicine to what we have now, especially with the recent AMSSM position stand on use of regenerative medicine and really call for increased scrutiny in our literature. So it's good that we're recognizing that now, but I don't think that should exclude us from tackling some of these long-term investigations. So can you tell us a little bit about the demographics and the number of patients involved in this study?
So we identified a total of 27 patients that fit our inclusion criteria. 27 procedures and 25 patients that fit our inclusion criteria. So essentially, the majority of our cohort was females. So 82% of our cohort was females. The mean age was 53 years, plus or minus 10. One thing that we did find that was interesting was that the BMI was actually, so we stratified our database on success and failure. And what we deemed to be a success was if patients reported a satisfaction of very satisfied or satisfied, we deemed that a quote unquote success. Any other category, they were deemed a quote unquote failure. So when we stratified the data, the BMI we actually found was higher in the success group relative to the failure group. When we looked at the duration of symptoms, really they were fairly equivocal, the success and failure group. So about 3.8 years on average, they had their symptoms. We also wanted to look at things like ultrasound thickness, the calcaneal inclination angle, the enthesophyte length, and those are some of the other things we wanted to qualify as well. And so we have that data that we're going to report on. And we also included if they had any previous procedures. So if they had previous physical therapy, had a previous corticosteroid injection, we analyzed that data as well. One thing I wanted to highlight that I think is important to talk about is part of this title was the needle fasciotomy portion. And so we did qualify the number of fenestrations. So we had categories of less than 30, greater than 30, and then repetitive fenestration. That was just how it was reported in the procedure log. So things like the number of fenestrations, what the proceduralists did in terms of their pre-procedural protocol, post-procedural protocol, like their post-procedural rehabilitation, we didn't necessarily capture that data just because there was too much heterogeneity in it. And so we didn't know we could do that due diligence. But those are just some things I think are important to think about when we think about these procedures. Certainly the cell composition itself, the PRP, that's an incredible thing. But we also need to talk about the type of machine that's been used, what settings they use, as well as, you know, how long they're holding NSAIDs before and after, what is their post-procedural rehabilitation plan. So those are just some things that I think that are important to think about for this procedure as well.
There's so many things to think about, so many different variables to analyze and everything. So ultimately, what were some of the key findings out of this retrospective analysis?
What we ended up finding was, so basically 81% of patients reported being very satisfied with this procedure. And so we were very intentional with using patient satisfaction as our primary outcome. The reason being is if we looked at just changes in VAS, then we would have found that a lot of the patients that we deemed quote unquote failures would have actually been qualified as success in our study. And so we found that patient satisfaction was going to be a better primary outcome in this cohort just because there was such a long duration that had it passed. So 81% reported being very satisfied with this procedure. We didn't find any complications for this procedure. So that's something to think about when we're performing this, is we always want to look at the safety of things that we do. For the PRP cell composition that was analyzed, so it was erythrocyte and neutrophil poor. It was monocyte and lymphocyte rich in the analyzed cases. Out of the 19 patients that we had, we were able to analyze four of those, and that was the composition of the PRP. The mean platelet concentration factor was 9.4, and the mean platelet cell dose was 13.6 billion platelets. The mean administered PRP volume was 2.97 milliliters. Something else I want to talk about, too, is that we had looked at what needle gauge was used. And so we found a range anywhere from 14 to 25 gauge needle was used. And we didn't, when we stratified the success and failure groups, we didn't find any difference between those two cohorts. So I think those are just something else to think about when you're performing this procedure. So really our takeaways from this study are, number one, this is the longest term study to date of outcomes using PRP needle fasciotomy for chronic plantar fasciopathy. And again, our time frame was 10 years that we found for the success group. We found that higher BMI and a baseline VAS pain scores were associated with successful outcomes following this procedure. And having a previous corticosteroid injection was not associated with worse outcomes. And so that's what we found that we could highlight from this.
Okay, great. Thanks for those findings. And what, if any, limitations did you identify?
Yeah, as with any study, I think it's very important to be honest and be very diligent about the limitations. And so from our study, first of all, because it was a retrospective study without a control group, that's something that is important to highlight. We were actually surprised, to be quite honest, that we had a small sample size. And so that was somewhat shocking to us that we, yeah, what size we had. But part of that is because, as we know, PRP people have to pay out of pocket for. And so there are other treatments that people use that are covered by insurance. And so that likely led to this smaller sample size. Now, there was heterogeneity in the available data. So I talked about that we only had PRP cell composition for 4 out of the 19 patients. And so that's one example in which there's somewhat of an incomplete data set. But in general, we did have some heterogeneity in what was available to us. This subject could have been subject to recall bias. I talked about the multiple procedural considerations for this procedure. And so there was really a lack of procedural standardization. So when we think about number of fenestrations, needle gauge size, quantity of local anesthetic, PRP dose, those were some of the things that were not standardized across all the procedures that we analyzed. And then finally, the PRP characterization. So we didn't have that for the earlier procedures, or if the patients didn't consent to our orthobiologics registry. And so again, we can't comment on the composition in those earlier patients.
All right. Thank you for that summary of some of those limitations and thoughtful things to consider for those who are also looking at PRP-based investigations. Now, Josh, taking the findings that you had, as well as the limitations, what would you say that this study embodies in regards to how we can implement PRP for plantar fasciopathy into our practice, or directions for further research?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, just want to put a plug in for having a system in place for patient-reported outcomes. I think separate from the procedure itself, I think it's very important that we have good systems in place for patient-reported outcomes. And so that's something that we have now in place at our institution. And so I think that that's one thing, is we want to start recording outcomes on all the procedures that we're doing. So I just want to put a plug in for that. Now, I still think that in terms of how does this fit into the treatment algorithm, or how could you counsel patients based on these findings? If I'm being honest, I still think we're in the infancy. I still think we still have more study to do to really be able to give strong recommendations just based on these findings. And so I think that it has a place. I think that I would still go through the standard of care before kind of going to this. And part of that being that, you know, patients are paying out of pocket for this. And so I think that this study really adds to literature in terms of what is the potential and how long the effects could last for this procedure. But I still think that there's a lot more work to be done on sanitizing when we implement this procedure and the number of fenestrations we use for this. What needle gauge size is most optimal? Should we use local anesthetic? Should we not use local anesthetic? Should we be using tibial nerve blocks? What is going to be our post-procedural protocol? And so I think there's still some work to be done on standardizing those aspects of things before we can give strong recommendations on where this fits in.
Fantastic. Really good summary of your presentation, studies, as well as some of the implications and applications to using platelet-rich plasma for plantar fasciopathy. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This has been a great experience.
In review of the recent 2023 AMSSM annual meeting in Phoenix, Arizona, today we are highlighting one of the award winners for best case presentation. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy Schroeder, and I'm joined today by Dr. Jacob Holtz. Jacob, it is so good to have you on today, and congratulations on being selected as the best case presentation.
Yeah, it's great. I appreciate you guys having me. Thank you so much.
It's always great to highlight some of our young AMSSM members as they go from fellowship into practice, and we're super excited to hear a little bit about your case podium presentation you delivered at our AMSSM annual meeting entitled Compressed for Time. Now, Jacob, can you set the stage with the case history?
Yeah, absolutely. So this case was that of a 17-year-old Brazilian exchange student, female soccer player, who came into our walk-in clinic on a Friday morning for right lower extremity pain that had started the day before at a soccer game. She was advised by her athletic trainer at that time not to participate in the game due to some of this pain. She chose to try to play, was able to make it about 10 minutes when she had to come out due to excruciating pain in that lower leg. She took about 20 minutes on the sideline before she could really move her foot and ankle anymore without excruciating pain. Pain subsided enough for her to go home, where she came to our office the following morning as she was still having some of this discomfort. After some discussion with her about this, it was revealed that she'd had a lower level discomfort similar to this for many years prior to her presentation at our office. She just had never sought evaluation in Brazil for it because it would go away after several minutes of rest, and she could continue to play for a few minutes before having to take further rest.
Oh, that's fascinating. So if I'm hearing you right, this is a case where this teenage female had an acute onset of exertional right lower leg pain. And did she have any sensory deficits in there as well, or is it just pain?
Yeah, so she was a near native speaker of English, but there were a few words that were kind of being lost in translation, and she did not have an interpreter with her at the visit. So doing a quick Google search, as one does, she kept saying that her foot felt dormant, the top of her foot felt dormant. So we found the Portuguese translation for numb, which was essentially dormente, pardon my lack of pronunciation in the native Portuguese. But we were able to translate that back to her, and it was revealed that she was having a sensory deficit over the top of that foot.
Okay, so this excruciating immediate onset of this exertional leg pain that occurred during the soccer match, but she did have some episodes in the past that occurred in both legs?
So primarily the right leg in the past, and what will be revealed a bit later is as we had a little bit more discussion, yeah, she did have some symptoms in the left. It just never was as severe as the right. It never limited her like the right leg did. She always had to stop due to the right leg, but did have some mild symptoms in the left as well.
But this is the worst time.
The worst time.
Interesting. So what was unveiled in your physical exam?
So the exam revealed a very visibly and palpably taut anterior and lateral lower extremity with some sensory deficits to the top of that right foot, as well as a cold sensation of the right foot as compared to the left. And then manual palpation of the dorsalis pedis pulse revealed that that pulse was diminished, nearly absent, especially when compared to the left foot.
Okay, so she, on physical exam, had tight, tender right lower leg, mostly in the anterior and lateral aspects.
Correct.
So then she had cool skin, decreased pulses, and decreased sensation. Were there any color alterations that were noted?
Yeah, so no color alterations were noted at the time of the exam. The other big finding was with active dorsiflexion and eversion of that foot, she had excruciating pain, as well as with passive plantar flexion of that foot.
Okay. So did you notice any fascial herniations?
There were no visible fascial herniations, both at rest as well as with some dynamic maneuvers of the foot.
Interesting. So now that we've had our history in physical and all of us are kind of creating this differential diagnosis in our head, can you go through what you guys were thinking in your differential diagnosis for this presentation?
So certainly on the differential, given the exam findings previously discussed, as well as the history, would be an acute compartment syndrome. However, we couldn't completely exclude a popliteal artery entrapment syndrome, a tibial fracture, cystic adventitial disease, or deep venous thrombosis.
Okay. And I would consider a chronic exertional compartment syndrome?
Based upon the history, it certainly is in the realm of possibility. However, given the acuity of the case, we couldn't exclude the acute component of this.
Oh, absolutely. So what was your next step?
So in our office, we fortunately have the capabilities to do compartment pressure testing. So we proceeded to go through our standard numbing procedure for that and tested each of the three compartments that we measure, which is the anterior, the lateral, and the deep posterior.
So what did you find on those? And can you compare that to what's normal for the listener?
Sure. So the compartment pressures we generally think of as between 0 and 10 millimeters of mercury. There's some argument in the literature of 15 to 25 being somewhat equivocal, but certainly less than 10 would be normal. In this young lady's case, her anterior compartment measured 85 millimeters of mercury, her lateral compartment measured 68 millimeters of mercury, and her deep posterior at 15.
Okay, so you just needed a resting compartment pressure test. Obviously didn't do any exertional.
Correct. In this case, the pressures spoke for themselves, so we were able to act upon those pressures relatively rapidly.
Cool. So those findings definitely indicated there was some compartment syndrome present. So what was your final assessment?
So the final assessment in this case was actually an atraumatic acute on chronic exertional compartment syndrome, which is unusual.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen acute compartment syndromes. I've seen plenty of chronic exertional compartment syndromes, but I've never heard of an acute on chronic exertional compartment syndrome, especially with an atraumatic presentation. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Certainly. So chronic exertional compartment syndrome is a relatively rare phenomenon. We certainly see that in the sports medicine world. However, the literature would suggest that the rate is about 0.5 per 1,000 person years in active populations. A literature search done by myself, my attending physician, my program director, and our medical librarian resulted in virtually no literature findings for any kind of atraumatic, acute on chronic exertional compartment syndrome, which is why I think this case is so unique and so rare.
Yeah, holy smokes. I wouldn't know where to go from that with being such an uncommon presentation. So what was the management for this acute on chronic exertional compartment syndrome?
Well, you've really nailed it right there with the first word of that is the acute component of this. With those pressure readings being that high, we really didn't have time to spare, especially that the patient was presenting about 14 hours after the original onset of symptoms. So the on-call orthopedic surgeon was contacted, who agreed to take the case and ultimately took the patient to the OR, where he performed a four-compartment fasciotomy via a two-incision approach.
So given those pressure testings, you definitely had elevations in the anterior and lateral compartments, but a normal resting pressure on the posterior compartments. Why the four-compartment release?
That's a great question. The surgeon that performed the surgery and I had a discussion about that approach, and he had felt that the posterior compartments were beginning to become more taut as time went on over the few hours between the patient being in our office and getting to the operating room. That being said, there is a bit of literature that would support a four-compartment release regardless of presentation of symptoms and pressure readings if you're indeed going to approach one or two of the compartments otherwise.
Very fascinating. Now, Jacob, every case needs an end to this story. What happened to this young athlete? Did she do well after the fasciotomy? Was she able to return to sport? What happened?
So she was able to progress back to some running activities at about 4 weeks postoperatively. She kept a close follow-up with the performing surgeon in his office. She kept a close follow-up with me in the athletic training room at the high school. And ultimately, she was able to return to her full level of competition at her previous level of function.
That's so awesome. What a rad and really uncommon case here. So Jacob, really appreciate your efforts in putting together this case, and obviously well rewarded as being the best case presentation at AMSSM. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your case with us, and really appreciate it and wish you all the best success in the future.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm grateful for Drs. Josh Romero and Jacob Holtz and congratulate them on their outstanding work. I'm excited to see and hear the great new scholarly activity on display at this year's annual meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, held on April 12th through the 17th. Please join us again soon for the next edition of the AMSSM Sports Medcast. The views expressed are ours alone and do not represent the official policy or position of the AMSSM, the Mayo Clinic Sports Medicine Fellowship, the Notre Dame Sports Medicine Fellowship, the Defense Health Agency, the U.S. Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government.